Well, the thing is that I, first of course, I want to thank all four panelists for their excellent work in presenting the picture about the mega regionals of the WTO from different triangles. I have too much to say, but I will constrain myself. are only 2 points where I think I might be able to make my humble contribution. The first one is, of course, on your question whether China should join the TPP. I should admit that I don't have any inside information. I'm not in charge of TPP or any FTA negotiation, except the China-Australia FTA negotiation. Right. I was the coordinator in the beginning, before I went to Geneva. But I've been following TPP for long. I think that there are two factors we need to look at. I think because of there are many factors behind this question, I mean, you need to look at. Because of the very special relations between China and the US, and because of the pure size of these two countries, and of course because of, including us, all the naughty academic people, some of whom have said that TPP is to the purpose of TPP is to exclude China, and some of others say that the purpose of RCEP is to exclude the US. That makes it extremely complicated. But I think to make it simple, two factors we need to look at is the first question is whether does China want to join. The second question is does the U.S. want China to be? I think those are the two main factors behind this question. The first one, whether China joins in, the thing is that for the moment, if you follow very carefully some of the very limited number of occasions where China's senior officials have publicly spoken about this, you will see that China has been very cautious. The reason behind that is, I think, embarrassingly, China is a country with a long history. So we always follow the wisdom of Confucius. And Confucius has once said that, as a gentleman, you need to avoid four things. The first one is that conjecture. Second one is dogmatism, third one is obstinacy, and last one is egoism. Right. So yeah. So the thing is that you don't presume, and you don't dogmatize, and you just don't refuse to adapt to new situation, and you try not to be arrogant. And to make it simple, as related to this is that Chinese will never say no immediately. A few things I think where you could see Chinese officials talking about this. First one is of course the assistant minister in charge from Mokang, Mr. Wang Shouwen, in April last year in Boer Forum. I will get it on my mobile phone. He said that TPP is very important because it takes 40% of world GDP, 50% of world trade, 30% of global FDI. China is very much concerned about development of TPP negotiation, and he's very much interested. He didn't say that we're interested in joining, he just said that we're interested in. But for the moment, China is not in. So that's what he said. Afterwards, I think he's in, afterwards, the Vice Minister of Finance, Mr. Zhu Guangyao, in October, also last year, when he made a speech at the Peterson, I think he did that in Peterson Institute.
Yeah,
the Peterson Institute. He said that for long there has been an internal debate in China about whether China should join the TPP. But China now has a very clear position on joining the global trading system, including high standard trade agreements like TPP. And also, I think that's a humble Chinese arrogance. He said that, considering the economic importance of China, any trading blocs without the participation of China is incomplete. And then the latest one, November last year, the spokesperson of MOFCOM, Mr. Shen Danyang, at the press conference for APEC Summit, he also said that we don't think the U.S. doesn't welcome China to be part of the TPP. And China is very much concerned about its negotiation process and is evaluating the development of this negotiation. APEC has many RTAs. China always holds that the APEC RTAs should be open and tolerant and to achieve a win-win situation. And before and after that, he also said that China is seriously evaluating the possibility of joining the TPP, but on an equal and mutual beneficial basis.
Okay.
So those are the limited occasions where you see Chinese senior officials publicly say that about it.
Yeah.
Reading from the lines, I think our the wisdom from Confucian is that we have not refused.
Okay.
And then, looking at the other side of the picture, what's the attitude towards the U.S.? Even more limited, I have only found two occasions where the U.S. Senior officials have talked about the possibility of China joining in. The first one is the Vice Minister, Vice Deputy Secretary of Commerce, Ms. Sanchez, I think that's the name.
Right.
And in May last year, very funny, he said that in Japan while he's visiting Japan. And he said that, if China could undertake the same level, high level of liberalization obligations as those prior participants, and then China is welcome. And he also emphasize that the purpose of TPP is not to exclude China. And the second one is by the Madame Susan Rice, the advisor National Security. National Security. She made a speech at the Georgetown University on November 20th. She said that the primary objective for the U.S. In the APEC region is to conclude the TPP. We welcome any country who would like to undertake the high-level obligations of the TPP result, and who could also benefit from the result of TPP, including China.
Right.
So those are the only two.
Okay.
Looking at that, you would also say yes, the U.S. has not said no. But one thing I have to make clear is that when China say that we don't think the U.S. doesn't welcome China, I think that's a diplomatic lie. The U.S. didn't say no, but it has said something with a condition. I think it's similar to what we have talked about TISA. We are welcome, but we need to know whether you are at our level. And how to know that? Show us your cards.
Yeah.
So it's the same story.
Yep. Okay.
So it's not the end of the story. But I'm reading from the story side, say that at least on China side, I think we are open-minded.
Okay.
The second thing I want to talk about is about the MIGA regional, so vis-a-vis WTO. Many have been talked about its implications and so on and so forth. But one thing about the possibility of bringing the MIGA regionals into the WTO umbrella, I think I think many panelists have touched upon this. I think that there are two things that are important. First is rulemaking. rulemaking in the sense that many things which are not dealt yet in the WTO are already dealt substantially in many, many different FTAs or RTAs. These are the things I think could potentially be brought back into the WTO umbrella for one purpose, and which would mean a lot for the many stakeholders, including businessmen, that is to harmonize them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, compared to many things, you will see that there are a lot of discrepancies among different RTAs on the same topic, be it on IP, be it on rules of origin, be it on labor standards, be it on human rights, whatever. And so I think that WTO could play the central role in harmonizing them. There's no other place you could do so. The second one is about dispute settlement. The thing for us is that, for me is that before you go directly into the dispute settlement mechanism upon the different provisions or disputes related to FTAs, the first thing is that you need to first fully utilize the existing mechanism in the WTO to know better about the RTAs.
Mm.
The first thing is that we already have a kind of on an interim basis the application of the RTA transparency mechanism there. And before I came back, my division was in charge of that. From what I have seen, the discussion and the transparency process on the RTAs in the WTO is very, to be very frank, very limited.
You're being diplomatic here.
Yeah, it's just still very much a kind of blah blah, simple information. Yeah, there's no real toughness in that process, which I think is a pity. Yeah.
Okay.
The second thing is that the many members have said that we need more studies. We need more in-depth analysis about different RTAs. And secretary actually on their own have done so. But with the same problem of consensus, that papers are not allowed to be circulated, to be discussed, to be looked at. And recently, before I came out, I saw a little bit kind of change of positions there. Some papers are coming, but we need to wait and see how far we could go on that. I think only after this transparency, further deliberation goes, and then it's far from we could use the WTO dispute settlement on that.
Hey, that's an excellent point.
Thank you very much.
I want to turn to Mr. Hoda and Mr. Rahman, but I'd like you to be brief because we're already pinging now into what is a very important next step. So I'd like your advice for India and Bangladesh about joining the TPP. After you've dismantled the machines.
Thank you, Jack. First, let me respond to your question about whether India would be joining or would like to join TPP. I would like to put it differently, because here I'm not a representative of the Indian government. So the question could be more appropriately phrased whether I would recommend that India should.
Perfect.
I would recommend India to not to think of joining the TPP at present. It has first to improve its infrastructure, the institutional infrastructure, as well as the physical infrastructure, to be in a position to cope with the high standard agreement that TPP is. The domestic regulations will have to be looked at and improved and reinforced as far as services are concerned, as far as manufacturers are concerned. The transport infrastructure will have to be developed into world class before we can be considered to be good enough to be able to join the TPP. So I'll be brief. I'll move to one other subject.
Okay.
One or two other aspects. Let me first respond to the point that Vera made about tariffs and misalignment of the exchange rates. Without going into great details, let me say that the importance of misalignment of exchange rates I do not deny, I recognize that. But about two or three decades ago, the question was studied whether in the WTO Secretariat, the tariffs were really important, tariffs and tariff reduction were important when exchange rate fluctuations were taking place with such amplitude. And at that time, the conclusion of the experts was that tariff reduction was still important. The tariffs, as well as misalignment of exchange rates, both when they act cumulatively, would be worse than they when they act singly. So that brings the importance of independently addressing the issue of tariffs, even if they have been reduced considerably all over the world, or the developed and the developing countries, they remain high on many products. Tariff peaks. Obviously, there are different definitions. The point regarding using the dispute settlement infrastructure of the WTO for the mega. I was wondering on what Mr. Yuvama, who is not here, commented about the WTO rules and the difficulties that the WTO needs to present. I thought that the idea was only to use the procedural aspects of the dispute settlement, not the substantive law of the WTO. Because the substantive law of the WTO is not applied to the relations between the parties to the negotiations. I think Mr. Rao has already asked the floor, so he might like to answer that aspect. Lastly, let me commend presentation made by Mr. Nakagawa on the impact of TPP on the WTO and what we have to consider in the WTO, considering the adverse impact that might be there for the non-participants in TPP. I think that the recommendations are very sound. The non-members of the TPP cannot do anything about the TPP, even if they are going to be adverse to their interests. The TPP is going to steam roll ahead. But what they can do is to improve the WTO agreement in light of the TPP so that the adverse effects are minimized. There is another sort of paper that has come out of the OECD Secretariat, which says something like this, that we should look at the FTA and mega regionals, not yet the mega regionals, the FTAs, and see what are the WTO extra, WTO beyond and WTO plus items on which a large number of FTAs are already, have already agreed. And if the individual member countries of the FTAs have agreed to them in the FTAs, there is good reason to expect them to agree to them if multilateral rules are proposed. And two areas which strike me as areas in which a large number of FTAs have already put provision inside them. And besides, one of them is investment. Now, I know that there was a big fight on investment not so long ago in the WTO. But the world has moved since then, and large number of RTAs have been adopted with investment in it, and competition policy also in it. And besides that, BITs are being negotiated. So all this suggests that we could look at, of course, in Bernard's paper also we have a list of subjects on which multilateral rules could be thought of. But to the extent that there is already discipline, agreed discipline on many of these in the FTA, we could consider them for multilateralization through the WTO. And if we do that, then to that extent, the difficulty posed by the TPP, which will certainly have the effect of drying up investment flows into the non-PPP countries. I think to that extent, the adverse effect will be minimized.
I think that's eminently worth thinking about. I'm now at a point where I have a choice between shot by Mr. Rachman for not calling on him or shot by Mr. Draper for unnecessarily shortening his panel. I have to confess I'm more scared of Mr. Draper. if I could beg your pardon, Mr. Bazir, I'm going to go straight to the next panel if I could.
Okay. Well, thanks very much, Mr. Cunningham. So, global value chains, that's the subject of the next panel. We've got four eminent speakers. I have asked some, I didn't have a chance to talk to Mr. Jiang at the tea break, but I've asked them to keep their presentations to no more than 15 minutes, which would take us up to the lunch break and leave no time for discussion. So if you can make it less than 15 minutes, that would be even better. I think the subject of global value chains is pretty well known. It's been much debated internationally. So if we can just focus on the core recommendations for the multilateral trading system, that would be good. And I did have some introductory remarks that I wanted to make, but I think I'll skip those and let's just get straight into the presentation. So, Bernard, over to you.
have one slide.
It'll take 20 minutes.
This slide can take a whole day, or it can take 5 minutes, and I'll take 5 minutes. So essentially, this kind of condenses down a lot of the thinking that, not just myself, but I'm on this whole issue, what are the policy implications of global value chain? So I'm not going to convince any of you that they're important and what's been going on, etc. We've had all of that ad nauseum, and it is very important. So I think in terms of policy implications, I think a lot of the policy implications are domestic. And we already heard a bit about that yesterday from a Chinese perspective in terms of breaking through the silos, in terms of the problem that you have. If you think about policy and value chain, you're pretty much talking about a large chunk of the behind the border agenda. So it's everything to do with not just customs, but also SPS, DDP, licensing, qualification, labeling, logistics, services, etc. So I think the real challenge is how do you put all that together in a way which is manageable? And a large part of the action there, I would argue, really has to be done domestically. Right, so you need to have, and this is the first three kind of boxes here, the track is really about the domestic agenda, which we can not really forget about, because I think the international agenda is partly to help kind of put in place those national infrastructures, but if you are serious about global value chains, you need to think about. So one is, and again, this is something not for discussion here, but you know, you need to have a national strategy, you need to have some kind of vision in terms of where you want to be as a country in terms of participating in value chains. Now that's something you have to do for yourself as a country. And I think an important element here is that you actually talk to the private sector. So in terms of putting these things together, there needs to be much more of a dialogue between business and government in terms of thinking through where are the major constraints, the frictions, etc. And that's difficult to do for some countries, not that difficult for others, but that's a necessary condition. I think the other element, and again this came up yesterday, is you need to have, because we're talking quite frequently about things that are absolutely out of the control of the trade industry, which matter for value chain, so there needs to be some mechanism where you bring this up to the highest level of kind of politics and government, other countries who actually deal with some of these items, right? So I think it was Lou who mentioned yesterday that MOFCOM is ranked 26? Is it 26?
Something like that.
Yeah.
So very low. Very good.
So, you know, that's where the WTO, those are the people who go to the WTO, who are involved in WTO discussion, and they have nothing to say domestically quite frequently, right? They're not a powerful ministry. So you need to have what I've called here this apex entity to coordinate and to ensure that insofar as you identify particular constraints that inhibit value chain participation, that you can address them. Third, domestic, and this is getting then closer into the WTO, because I think one of the questions to ask is, okay, so where can international cooperation help you and deal with these domestic challenges? And obviously there's a lot of political economy working underneath these recommendations in terms of line ministries not wanting to do what they should be doing, competition between provincial and municipal, state level government, and so forth. But the third recommendation here, or the policy implication, is okay, we have the trade facilitation agreement. And I think one of the things that really could be done from a GVC point of view, and of course GVCs are not global, they're regional, there's all kinds of them, and they're not chains or networks. I also won't get into that dimension, so it's a convenient shorthand, but I think it actually is getting increasingly negative baggage, so you know, I think it's worth thinking about not using the GVC acronym because it has a lot of antibodies. Leverage the Trade Facilitation Agreement. So the Trade Facilitation Agreement requires national trade facilitation committees. Right now, many governments already have those things to a greater or lesser extent, but I think there is an opportunity if you really want to kind of focus on dealing with some of these constraints, the greater value chain participation, is to say, well, given that we have those mechanisms already in place, let's broaden the mandate so that we can actually address not just narrow trade facilitation as defined by the WTO, but also deal with logistics, to deal with potential standards, whatever the priorities might be. And I think this is, again, an important way of cutting through the silos that exist, not just domestically, but also internationally. Right? Because we have the WTO, we have all these various committees. In a sense, it's completely ridiculous that we have a trade facilitation agreement, but we also have a customs valuation agreement. We have an import licensing agreement. All
all of this stuff is customs, right? So, and again, if you ask, so to what extent are all these Tanikis actually talking to each other, the answer you frequently get, well, not a whole lot. Whereas it's really the same agenda. I think also here there is a link and the reason for leveraging this trade facilitation committee is I think that's the entry point of the development community, right? So the international organizations that are there to actually help deal and improve competitiveness of domestic firms by getting rid of barriers to various entry, barriers to operation, and so forth. I think that's the innovation of the trade facilitation agreement. And again, here I think making that link to the development community to the priorities that have been established by governments in terms of their national trade strategy or the national development plan is really important. And I think here there really is a big danger. Because if you look at the way the World Bank, for example, it has been done, if you just look at the whole response to trade facilitation, right, so everybody is falling over themselves to help countries implement the trade facilitation agreement. Right, and I can tell you the people that I know who are doing that are basically just looking at the agreement. Right, and just ticking off boxes. Oh, we gotta do single windows, so let's do single windows. So they're not looking at this holistically, they're not looking at it strategically, so I think it's an easy recommendation to make. I think it's an important recommendation to make. I think it's also difficult to do that because all the incentives, again, in the donor community right now is just focusing on the trade facilitation agreement, whereas they really should be focusing on trade facilitation. So again, it's a domestic issue, and I think the governments that actually managed to do this in a way that they focus on the real constraints, on the kind of focusing on what do we need to do to enhance our ability to participate in value chains, can do very well out of this system. The ones that don't are not going to get a whole lot out of it because it's going to be an exercise of ticking boxes without really dealing necessarily with real priorities. Okay, then we have the two international cooperation bits here. And one is to really start thinking more seriously about pursuing a whole of the supply chain approach to the design of trade agreements. I think proposed Bali, given that we're focusing here on the multilateral trading system, I think at the very least, start thinking about putting in place a working group where we can think about, okay, so what are some of these issues that are missing from what is currently in the WTO with respect to participation of value chains in international production networks? And I think ultimately kind of create this space for a plurilateral agreement where countries that want to can actually go further and start thinking about ways of cooperating. This does not have to be subject to dispute settlement, it doesn't have to be binding enforcement, but at the very least, to go beyond just talking to say, okay, let's actually do something X, Y, Z in an area which will help facilitate and enhance participation in value chain. So that's the very actual approach. A critical mass based, right? So I don't think it makes much sense if we're talking about value chain participation to think about discrimination. So it's really about how can we leverage what we have, how can we fill the gaps with what is in the WTO today in terms of from a focused perspective on value chains. And that might include rules of the game, right? But I think that's really endogenous. So I think the deliberation process should identify where you might need some more binding rules, but you don't really find that from the get-go. So I think on this deliberation, which is the fifth bit here, I think we need a lot more work on actually figuring out, you know, what are the constraints to participation. But I think very importantly from the perspective of many of the lower income countries in the WTO, they're very worried about who gets the loot. Right? So it's really about they worry about distributional effects, they worry about are the multinationals taking all of the profits and ribbon all we do is we're a sweatshop for the world, which we don't want to be. We want to move up the value chain. So we have this economic upgrading dimension, the social upgrading dimension, and those are really important. And we don't know a whole lot about that. I think there's quite a bit that has been done on this in the development literature, but it really hasn't focused on the trade policy dimensions and what you might want to do through the WTO. So I think here there's a lot of analytical work that needs to be done. That can partly be done through that working group idea, but I think it also requires quite a bit of secretarial support. The WTO secretariat is in principle you can want to do that. In practice, of course, there's a lot of antibodies to that. We heard Lou just now about saying, no, we don't actually do this type of thing. So I think there is an issue for us to think about collectively people often say secretary to this, secretary to that, but who, it might actually not be the most productive way of pursuing this initially. So here you could think of the countries that actually are involved in that group. And then there's a resource dimension to this as well. Again, I won't belabor the point, but I think you do need to have that type of work done. Same thing on the distributional effects, right? And we talked yesterday a bit about the price of the wine in Beijing, right? So the hypothesis we came up with, there must be some kind of anti-competitive behavior going on. But again, it's an example of where at the end of the day, if you don't have enough competition within various dimensions of the value chain, then the guy who is sitting on the bottleneck facilities is going to get all of the rents. Right? So I think we need to do a lot more analysis of identifying where is this actually happening, where do we need to worry about it. And again, that's something where in principle you could think about multilateral rules at some point once you've kind of figured out what the contours of the beast are. And of course, then we get back to competition, which was thrown out of the WTO. But again, I think it's the type of issues where many of the industrialized countries did not want to have a discussion when there was a discussion of competition policy issues, because it was all about what developing countries should do for themselves. It wasn't about the externalities that are created by the behavior of entities which are outside of your jurisdiction, right? So I think this will get you back, I think, to where there was a lot of discussion on this in UNCTAD in 1967, at least in the sense we're kind of moving in circles, but I think that is an issue which I personally don't think is all that much of a big deal, but I think there isn't enough evidence on that. I think we need to do a lot more work on that. Thanks.
Great. Thanks, Bernard. It was a tour de force and one slide. Very impressive. So next we have Deborah from the realm.
Very good one. I stole the slide from the
layout.
I did the
layout. I am going to bridge the gap between the last panel and this one, actually, and talk about what are the mega regionals doing about value chains. And I will undermine my own business premise, frankly, by saying that although there are a lot of things that are value chain friendly in the mega regionals, especially TPP, this is not the be-all and end-all for firms. So firms operating in value chains often have no idea what is in various agreements or not in various agreements, which suggests to me that although we can spend a lot of time and energy and effort and money negotiating these things, at the end of the day, business may or may not use them anyway. So even if you're not in a mega-regional, all is not lost, because there's plenty of opportunity for your firms, or large and small, to plug into value chains. Because again, you don't have to have supply chain friendly agreements in order to get supply chain friendly policies. So I'm going to skip over the context for trade. I don't know why this is so strange looking. Let me just go right to the discussion about what this is. So one of the important things to realize is that I hear all the time people say, oh, your tariffs don't matter anymore. But that's not true, actually. For value chains, tariffs can be hugely important, even tiny value, even tiny tariffs. And I think this is a useful thing to recall. When you have complicated products, especially, for every component inside of that complicated product, you may have even a small tariff. And by the time that you finish with a complicated product, like this laptop, this microphone, whatever, the embedded tariffs inside of that can be tremendously high. We're looking at 35-45% tariffs, depending on the products, on many of the more complex products, even when the actual tariff is 2%, 3%, 5%. So saying that tariffs are low does not actually help you in the value chain world. You need tariffs to be as close to zero as possible, and preferably at zero, because that makes a big difference for companies. Tariff amplification is another huge problem, particularly for food, which is, again, like the raw coffee beans might be at 5%, but the roasted coffee beans 10%. The coffee mix is another, I don't know, 25% tariffs, and by the time you hit the Starbucks bottle frappuccino, it's 45% tariffs. That tariff escalation is hugely problematic for value chains because it keeps countries and firms, especially, from moving into higher value issues in processing, especially for food. So tariff escalation and tariff amplification are both challenges that can be addressed. They can be addressed through trade agreements, but again, they don't have to be. You can do it unilaterally. Trade facilitation is not just a hassle. A trade facilitation problem, any delay at the border for components or finished goods is catastrophic for value chains. Because it costs time, it costs money, and for a firm trying to do business, they will move elsewhere. They're very mobile, so if they can't get the parts and components they need quickly and easily and cheaply across borders, they'll find someone who can. So any delay that you have in trade facilitation is, I repeat, catastrophic, especially for your smaller firms. Standard, we talked about standards this morning, and the costs are added to every single product. So if you say, well, we have lots of, you know, what do the tariffs actually look like? Let me just give you briefly. This is the TPP members' agricultural tariffs, because I happen to have this chart handy. For TPP members, just in agriculture, I'd take out Canada and Malaysia because the figures would mess up my chart. But you can see that the extent to which we still have tariff peaks and the extent to which we have tremendous variation between countries that you might otherwise have thought of as relatively similar. Again, not all the TPP members are the same, but even if you compare across the more developing members of the TPP and the more developed members of the TPP, you can see huge variation in the tariff level. So one of the things that the best approach to value chains would be a global agreement, because this is much easier for global value chains working in a global environment with the same rules that apply everywhere. But in the absence of that, we have the move towards the mega regionals that we've been talking about. And the two that are going on right now is RCEP and the TPP. We hardly have mentioned RCEP, which is not surprising because no one mentions RCEP. I mentioned yesterday that no one mentions WTO to me when they come talk to me from companies, but actually no, I've only had two companies talk to me about RCEP. So it's not just that the WTO is sidelined, also companies are not paying any attention to RCEP. Even after I described to them what's in it and why they should pay attention, they're still like, yeah, whatever, I'm not paying attention. So the issue here, I think, well, I don't know why these slides are so like crazy, but I apologize for that. The key difference to me about the mega regionals in terms of value chains is that in the past, a lot of the value chain friendly policies were not included. So for example, nobody much worried about electronics goods because they said, oh, well, the ITA covers electronics goods, so we don't need to worry. We have low tariffs there. We'll just leave them, or we'll leave them relatively untouched. The tariffs in general, as I just said, are low. We had huge carve-outs, especially in agriculture, so very few existing agreements cover agriculture in a meaningful way. And most of the existing agreements in Asia are goods-only agreements. And goods-only agreements in the value chain world is a disaster because most of the value in the value chain is actually on the services side. Depending on the product, and again, we find this in some of the statistics, we find it in this case study project that we're running, the value of a manufactured good can be between 40 and 70% services. Even in manufacturing something like a table, the services component is very, very key. And if the services are not opened, and if investment is not open, then it's very problematic for firms, even manufacturing firms, making tables to participate. So you can't just have a goods-only agreement, which is why the new agreements are a better arrangement than existing PTAs, preferential trade agreements here in Asia. The TPP, you all know about the TPP. I would just say that one of the TPP is almost done, so I don't know why we ever even talk about who's going to get in now. We hopefully will be done next month, and we won't have to keep talking about that. But what's different about it? So this is the standard slide that I give what's different about the TPP. The key thing really is that it's broader, so it covers all goods, or all goods with the possible exception of sugar and rice, but nonetheless, all goods. And it covers services, it covers investment, it covers all of these other issues, procurement, e-commerce, and the crucial thing for me is that it's meaningful promises for opening. So tariffs go essentially to zero, and I'll talk about this in just a second, so it's much broader than the existing agreements. It's also deeper than the existing agreements, so it covers a lot of the behind-the-border stuff that matters a great deal to firms that is normally carved out of agreements. And the third part is that it has a shared norm. The shared norm is every member of the TPP is a member of the TPP with the same obligations as every other member, with some delays in implementation timeline. So when we come to the TPP and GDCs, what are the rules in there and how do they make a difference? Mostly the goods rules are sensible. They're not perfect because we're still arguing over last generation or two generations ago problems in goods, dairy, textiles, you know, stupid things. But in general, tariffs on 90% of goods will drop to zero on entry into force in the TPP. So just think about that for a moment. So 90% of all tariffs will go to zero by potentially January 2017. That is the starting point for the TPP, and if you look at that compared to other Asian agreements, we are starting above the level of nearly all existing FTAs in the region. So you start at 90 and you go for upwards from 90. Close to 100, not completely, but close to 100% at zero. Most of the rest come in relatively short order, 7 to 10 years. Of course, I say that to business, and business says 7 to 10 years, I'll be gone by then. But nonetheless, in the trade world, 7 to 10 years is likely. There is no more tariff escalation because you don't have all those coffee products all the way through the Starbucks Frappuccino is now zero. So that gives an opportunity for firms engaged in the TPP member countries to produce goods all the way across the value chain at the same zero tariffs. There are less helpful rules of origin. They went for product-specific rules of origin. It's a pain in the ass. It's a particular nightmare for accumulation. Big companies, I think, will fix this, because if you have 28,000 employees, you can dispatch a whole army of people to a room for 2 years to sort it out for your inventory. If you're a small firm, it's actually not a problem, because you hardly export anything, so you can sort it out for your firm, for your small amount of things, or small amount of markets. If you're a medium-sized firm, this is going to be a nightmare because the system is so complicated most people use it. There's a lot in the TPP on trade facilitation, on customs, on processing, on border clearance, more expansive, I think, than we see like in Bali, with a whole lot less of the members shall to the best of their abilities. No, members shall. There is a lot of services and investment liberalization, although I would say not as much services liberalization as I would have hoped, because the members are less visionary about the importance of services than I would have been. There are some GDC-specific rules in there, especially around things like express delivery, logistics, this sort of thing. We talk a lot about how standards are going to be discussed in the TPP, and the reality is there's almost no harmonization, coherence, cooperation of standards in the TPP. They had a vision of doing that at the beginning, but when they sat down to actually do it, it turned out to be almost impossible. So there are very few actual changes on the standard side in the TPP. There's a hope to do so in the future, but at the moment, not really. Just the rules on SPS mostly. So that's the TPP rules that are GDC. Now on RCEP, many of you are not paying attention, I assume, to RCEP. RCEP is the 10 ASEAN members plus what they call their 6 dialogue partners. The idea behind RCEP was to multilateralize these trade agreements. So ASEAN already has 5 existing agreements that they call ASEAN plus ones. The idea behind RCEP was let's multilateralize them. Let's harmonize across the 5, put them all together, and wouldn't that be a whole lot better? And certainly wouldn't that be a whole lot better for value chains? In a connected world, we have this connection. And the idea here, it sounds good. It's supposed to cover goods, services, investment, intellectual property rights, e-commerce, and competition. That's it. So this is not TPP. This is not 29 chapters from the beginning. It's much, much less ambitious. And then the kicker, and the thing that's going to kill it in the end, in my view, is official and differential treatment is allowed in RCEP. And remember that all of the countries in RCEP, except for Japan, Australia, and New Zealand, are developing, including South Korea and Singapore, are still classified as developing. So you could be wildly creative if you wanted to about getting out of any of the commitments. Now, we only had 7 rounds of RCEP, so we don't know where the end point will be. It's supposed to end at the end of this year. Hopefully it will not, because it will really be a bad agreement if it ends then. But what we do know is that it will be far less ambitious on the good side. So, unhelpfully, India, China, and South Korea came together with a proposal for 40% liberalization on tariffs. Not to zero, just opening it all. 40% with a goal of getting to 65% in RCEP. This is hopeless. I don't even really know what the point of the paper was if you're going to do that. There is a counter proposal to push it all the way up to 80% of goods coverage at the end of implementation. But no matter how you slice it, you can see that the goods coverage in terms of tariffs and tariff reductions is nowhere compatible to the TPP. So helpful, yes, not as helpful as TPP, especially for value-connected firms. There will be a lot of scope for tariff escalation. There will be very little coverage, I assume, of most agricultural sectors since they're highly sensitive across most of the TPP 16. The one thing that RCEP has going for it that TPP does not is that RCEP is based on ASEAN agreements. The one thing that ASEAN does well is rules of origin. So the rules of origin will likely be much cleaner, much easier to use for firms than the TPP. It will not be product specific. It will be more of the blanket, and it will often be co-equal rules. So you can use one or the other of several conditions. So business tends to like that until, I might add, they hit the customs. And the customs decides how they want to interpret that set rules, at which point it's less helpful. So in that case, product-specific rules of origin for firms can be easier, because at least they're very clear about what does and doesn't get covered, and they have less of a battle coming. The services and investment promises in RCEP are likely to be very light, partly because of who's sitting there and how lack in enthusiasm many of the countries are and how defensive they tend to be on services and investment. And most of the rest is not covered. So we don't have a whole, you know, there's nothing in here on IP. There's a tiny, tiny, tiny bit on IP. I think it will just say, do what you already promised to do on IP. That's about it. It says have a competition law. We'll see whether that happens. I mean, it's pretty thin on here. And because of SMD, you could wiggle out of anything that you wanted to wiggle out of. So the answer I would say is that although we have some GVC-friendly rules in these mega-regionals, they are not in and of themselves going to make or break firms that want to operate in a GVC world. So they will maybe take advantage of some of these provisions, maybe not. It depends on how complicated they are, how easy they are to use, how much education we have, and outreach to businesses. But clearly there are at least an attempt to move GVC-friendly policies in a positive direction, especially TPP, in a way that hopefully will encourage supply chain connectivity going forward in this region. So let me just stop there. But I would, the final note to get it back to the WTO is that as you continue to make this sort of thicket of incompatible rules, you know, you may end up having to go back to the WTO to sort out the mess that you're making. And I would argue one of the bigger problems is actually not, everybody talks about the spaghetti bowl rules of origin. I think that's a minor problem compared to what's coming in the services side, for example, where you have services rules or services opening, for example, different across multiple agreements that ensnares an official in a way that they, I don't think they appreciate that. Because when I ask questions, everybody's like, well, I don't really know. And you say, well, isn't this incompatible with that? Oh, maybe. So I think we're going to have increasingly countries are going to get themselves stuck, and we may have to go back to the WTO, or it will be a mess by then. We'll just stop there. Thank you.
I have a technical question, boss.
Yes.
What's the basic criteria of rules of origin? Is a jump tariff shift, or is not value added at all?
It depends. So in RCEP, it's value added. Usually in RCEP, let me back up. In ASEAN agreements, it's always regional value content, so an RVC rule, and it's normally very low. It tends to be in ASEAN at 40%, but then they usually have a co-equal rule like change in tariff heading or change in tariff classification. So they have one or the other. So again, the one helpful thing I think about ASEAN has been its rule of origin methods. But actually when I talk to companies, they will often say to me, no, I mean, it sounds, so as a trade person, I thought, well, that's got to be better, right? Well, we have these generic rules, very easy to use. But they tell me that actually that creates all sorts of problems with customs. Because customs then can be extraordinarily creative about what they do or don't include at the border. And that if you have product-specific rules of origin, although they're a royal pain in the ass to use if you're a company, at least it's quite clear what is and isn't covered. And so, in a way, that can be easier. But accumulation across product-specific rules, you can imagine if every component in here has a product-specific rule of origin, to figure out how much of this is going to be TPP content is really, really difficult.
Great. Thanks very much, Kevin. So now we'll turn to Mr. Chan.
Okay. Actually, I'm often saying a good word to other people and other countries. Sorry, my English like this. Yeah. Regarding GVC, I just like to talk about three points. The first one is that I think a global value chain is very critical, you know, for Asia, both in the past and in the future. If you look at China as an example, you know that in the past, actually, China had already been involved in the global value chain. Also, China got a lot and benefited from that process. You have to notice that if you look at the history, world manufacturing center gradually shifts from one country to another country, from UK to Germany, from Germany to the US, from US to Japan, and then it moved to China. But in the last 35 years, actually, this process is quite different from other, you know, shift process. Just because, you know, vertical specialization happened in the world, and the globalization process accelerated. And then China just, you know, got those opportunities. And then today, China becomes, you know, world manufacturing center, as well as the biggest, you know, trading goods country in the world. But next stage, you know that now in China, you may find that China's labor cost gradually, you know, every year, 10%, you know, climbing up. Also, if you look at China's situation, you may find that China's residents started to complain about, you know, environmental pollution, as well as too concentrated manufacturing sectors. Every year, now China's manufacturing sectors contribute to China's GDP more than 42%, and our service sectors only 48%. So that means the next step, China should, you know, promote more and more manufacturing sectors, you know, go global and invest in other economies. So I do believe that maybe next stage, maybe India and maybe other countries, because your life, your life of manufacturing sector. Meanwhile, you have so a lot of, you know, cheap labor and not so high quality labor force. And you have to have your industrialization process. In China, we have our, you know, valuable experiences that is without manufacturing sectors, you would not be get rich, especially for those poor people and those low quality, you know, labor force. So I think that global value chain will provide opportunities, not only for China, but also for ASEAN, for India. Yeah, this type of developing economies, as well as those small economies, you know, in the region. And the second point, I like to emphasize that if global value chain will be more relying on regional economic integration, I don't think so. China is a very good example. You know that in the past, actually, China didn't sign those free trade agreements with other economies. We have no process of regional economic integration, but global value chain, you know, happened in China, and vertical specialization happened in China. So I think that the most critical factor that is opening up. In China, we have our first round of reform and open up, and we China accepted so a lot of, you know, investors from, you know, global market, from other economies, and then gradually China has our, you know, accelerated industrialization process. Meanwhile, in that process, China's domestic firms also change and becomes more and more competitive. In this regard, I think that for other economies, you know, in Asia, especially for India and for other countries, opening up, becomes more and more opening up, can accelerate, you know, your international labor division process, and you can get your opportunities. Of course, in that process, we know that ASEAN now is the most liberalized region, you know, in East Asia. I think that ASEAN is very qualified, you know, to accept more and more opportunities from, you know, Asia Pacific region, as well as from a global market. So I think that the most important thing is that you have to change your investment environment. And meanwhile, you have to connect it with international market. And you have to rely on action to promote, you know, a global value chain happening in your economy. In this regard, I think that, you know, for Russia, you know that actually Russia is a very powerful, you know, country in the world. But if you look at the economy very often, and also even if Putin is very often said that Russia has to, you know, beyond the resources and the energy sectors, and we have to change our, you know, we have to restructure Russia's economy, but no way. So the problem is that Russia cannot be, you know, involved in global value chain. This is a very heavy problem. So a good example that is, you know, in China we have our very famous brand of Huawei. Maybe you know Huawei brand. Now Huawei has already set up their R&D, you know, department in Russia, relying on, you know, Russians very brilliant brain for calculation and for, you know, software. So I think this is a very important, you know, connecting. The third point I like to say that in China now, you know that we have our One Belt and One Road initiative. This is a new type of regional economic cooperation. On this platform, on one hand, we will promote regional economic integration, but on the other hand, we also realize that it would be impossible for China to promote, you know, bilateral or multilateral FTA with some of economies, such as Russia, such as, you know, some of Islamic countries. That would be very difficult. But we will appreciate, you know, our, you know, comprehensive regional economic cooperation process. And we will have our, you know, complicated, systematic regional economic cooperation. You know that AIIB and the Silk Road Fund will provide, you know, initial capital for infrastructure improvement. In that process, PPP will be promoted. And then they will create better investment environment and business investment for those international investors. And then more and more, you know, investments will concentrate along the routes. And then you will find that global value chain gradually will be created along the routes. And in that process, I think that global value chain will play a critical role, especially, you know, vertical specialization. This type of process, if could be happened along the routes, that means, you know, that China's over-concentrated, you know, production, manufacture production capacity will be distributed into other, you know, economies. And then, you know, we will change China's economic structure. China's economic development model will become more sustainable. Meanwhile, other, you know, economies along the routes also can get very, very valuable, you know, development opportunities. In this regard, I think that global value chain will promote, you know, bilateral, inter-regional trade, as well as inter-regional investment. And then, you know, that our economic cooperation process, maybe in the future, economic integration process will be promoted. So this is a very complicated, you know, systematic project. Lastly, I, you know, that I will emphasize that just before we are also talking about, you know, mega FTA issues, as well as standard issues, something like that. Also, this type of issue actually connected with the global value chain. I just like very briefly make a few comments. The first comment is regarding standard. I noticed that some of the speakers are talking about this point. I'd just like to emphasize on that actually there are two types of standards. One is a standard to liberalization, standard of liberalization for mega FTAs. And another type of standard is a technical standard. And you mentioned so lot of, full of pictures, technical standard. I don't think that a technical standard will be the barriers for regional economic integration, because business firms and those transnational corporations, they will, have their, brilliant talents to solve these type of problems. But liberalization standards, I saw as those issues behind the borders, emphasized for TPP, actually will be the obvious barriers for developing economies in process of regional economic integration. So I think this is the most important issue. The second point regarding, should China join TPP? Could China join TPP? At this stage, I don't think this is a true question. The true question is that now the U.S. has already expressed, their warmest welcome. They hope China can join, because that means the market scale will be more meaningful. On the other hand, China also expressed, willingness, said that we want to join. But the problem is that there is a big gap between China and the U.S. For China, we want to join, but U.S. says that, U.S. side will say that as a latecomer, you have to accept all rules and regulations have been set up, for the initiator. Meanwhile, if you want to join, you have to have, one by one, bilateral negotiation as the preconditions. So that means it would be impossible for China to join, in short term. But on the other hand, you may find that not only the U.S., but Japan also, Japan, that last year I made my presentation in CSIS. And over there, both Japanese people and the U.S., representatives, they said that if China can join TPP, that means that's equal to China's second time to join WTO, and you can get really benefit from that problem. But the problem is that we can't. So here, I think that there is a very important, fact that is actually TPP is definitely beyond the development stage for developing economies. So that means in the future. So my third point for that is how to go to AFTA in Asia Pacific region. And from US side and Japan side, Japanese side, they said that we hope we can extend the TPP. In the future, China and Indonesia can join, and then we can, formulate it AFTA. I said that I may understand this position. The problem is that both China and Indonesia, even if India and others, a lot of countries, they said that your standard is too high to make, those economies involved in. So how? But for China, at least for China and Indonesia, we will say that, come on, your standard is too high. We cannot, pick up. But our standard, maybe our standard would be more comfortable and more flexible for developing economies. And then, if you can move to this track, so at least in there, this is a possible second track. But I'm afraid that U.S. and Japan will not agree this type of, solution. And then maybe the possible third track, that is TPP team and RCEP team, they can renegotiate another template. So that's why, during the 2014 APEC in Beijing, I noticed that the General Secretary of APEC, he said that he said to media, he said that in the future, if we want to chase after, at least right now, there are a few different approaches, and we have to study, you know, which approach would be, you know, possible for the future. So last sentence, I will say that actually those mega FTA will promote, you know, WTO development. Instead of, you know, I don't agree some of the scholars say that mega FTA are discriminatory for other economies. Sorry, just before when our scholars have this viewpoint, I don't think so. Meanwhile, you may find that those mega FTA will promote, you know, driving force, new driving force for WTO negotiations and stimulating, you know, WTO process. I just stop here. Thank you.
Wow, that was extremely interesting. All right, so we've been on time, more or less. Over to you. And we may even have some time for brief questions, answers, comments, etc. Not yet. We're going to take the final presentation.
Sorry to confuse you with my presentation. My notes not in here, of course. And also I have to mention that the 5-year goal objective is not it's kind of minor compared to the services I gave. I'm gonna actually focus on the minor today. But I think it has very fundamental implications for the country. So first of all, we all know that the economy is in, and we call it the new normal since 2008, and the growth potential is decreased. And some of those protectionism and some of those the importance of the non-trade measures, such as the TBTs and FTAs mentioned by Vera earlier. So the trade growth rate has slowed down, seems to be about the same growth rate as the GDP. We talked about this yesterday with the Bernard. So, do we see any paradigm shift in the global trade system? So I'm not going to go over all this, the WTO and MTS issue and mega FTA, but more on the fragmentation and the role of the rules of origin. I borrowed this from Brunner's earlier presentation in you can see that vertical specialization compared to 1995. In 2009, basically what we see is that the intermediate goods trade has increased a lot. And we all know the very famous example of iPhone. And so I go to the rules of origin, basically. So in terms of the electronics, we can see that in Japan, actually, they make tax films and all that materials and devices, and ship them to Korea, and Korea makes LCD panels, and then ship it to the Mexico, and those LCD panels are applied to the cell phone, and then sold in the U.S. And in the case of the textile, we can see that this dotted line is before TPP. So for example, the yarn price made in China is $2.2 per kilogram. And then it's going to be exported to Vietnam because it has the price advantage. But if now with the Korea at Vietnam FTA, with the $2.5 per kilogram, will beat the price of China because the price plus the tariff China has to pay. But now, if TPP is done, then maybe Japan might be the one who's providing the yarn to Vietnam because of this rules of origin issue. So, What I'm saying is that, okay, I have a little bit different perspective from Mr. Zhang, Professor Zhang, because China has been doing well without having to participate in the trade agreement in the past, because it's doing well in the GDP, because it was a one-shot game. I mean, when we talk about trade divergence act, okay, it's mostly about the efficiency loss because of this, you know, the market distortion. But now, even if you know the Korea, let me go back to Korea, you know, price plus tariff is still more efficient than Japan. Still, Vietnam might import from Japan because the game is not a one-shot game anymore. That product is going to be processed and then reshipped to another country. So if this is the value chain with the oldest, the intermediate products and the much more processes, so that the importing country will have to think about whether this will be potentially considered as part of the TPP rules of origin. And if that, so that's why here, if Korea actually produces about 20% of the t-shirts, but the Korea's, portion will not be counted as the part of the TPP, rules of origin. And then that means very different implications for the trade diversion. And this will have the much bigger impact on the production and the trade pattern. And so, I know that Deborah also mentioned that this GBCs are market driven, and I agree completely. The cult issues that I will talk about. Because in the market, okay, the firms will go to wherever they can produce most efficiently, right? And then, it is a matter of whether the country is going to be in or not. So it's kind of the club membership, and that's going to be a big difference from the traditional trade diversion effect. Okay. And there's going to be some implications for inequality issues. Because, okay, it's very good in the outset, there's the SND treatment, but not in all the mega FTAs. But we have, in the WTO or the multilateral trading system, we actually consider some of those LDCs and those, some of those SMEs and so on. So there's going to be some inequalities for the SMEs and the LDCs. And it's going to be the SMEs there are in the developing countries or the least developed countries that are having the problems in the integrating into the GBC. So when it's combined with the mega FTAs, then the market distortion issue that I mentioned, and then it's going to be redirected by those the regional agreements rather than the it's not going to be just market forces. Okay, and so there's going to be some implications for the trade between the mega trading bloc and the issues that we will have to think about how to multilateralize this issue, and also some of those individual countries alternatives, and that will have different implications from what we have been seeing in the past. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Joel. Very interesting. I think we need to explain the one-shot game a little bit more, but maybe we'll get to that. Okay, so just because I was going to give some introductory remarks, but I think I'll just use these now. A couple of them have been answered already. So Bernard's point about terminology, global value chains, has become something of a loaded term, increasingly contested. What's global, what's regional? I prefer the term cross-border value chains. It's more neutral somehow. And that might be something we want to consider, particularly in light of what I'm going to say next, which is that the term is contested, as you know. I have to say this everywhere I go. If you go to South Africa and you talk to policymakers and you say global value chain, immediately their eyes goes over and they get angry because they see global value chain is equal to the Washington Consensus. And Washington Consensus means drop your barriers so the multinationals can come in and invest in the market and presumably exploit you. Which makes me think I really want to get Mr. Zhang to South Africa to explain the global value chain story as we see it, because it's a story that's not coming across strongly enough in our debate. But I also wondered, and this didn't really appear in the conversation to date, everything we've heard up to date is about China performing, opening up further perhaps, but also wanting to move up the value chain. And in the literature that Bernard alluded to, there are different perspectives about the kinds of policies you can use to upgrade within the value chain. So the kind of perspective that's emerged in South Africa is, in order to move up the value chain, we should make entry into our market conditional. So you make it more difficult for multinationals to get into your market. In a sense, we're going where India hopefully is coming from, or perhaps China is coming from, but I'm not sure about where China is at that in terms of its thinking on the upgrading issues and the kinds of policies required, and therefore how that would translate into, say, the WTO or TPP or whatever else. Which then brings me to the WTO, so I think we need to toss this around a bit. A number of people have posed the question, will outsiders accept mega regional rules as cooked up in the TPP and perhaps the TTIP? We haven't spoken much about the TTIP. And within that, it seems to me it's been an unstated assumption, perhaps, that China perhaps holds the key to answering that question. Because if China does ultimately sign up, because it will be a case of just signing up to the TPP rules, then it seems to me everybody else has to adjust to China's decision, because China will then want to bring that back into the WTO, right? So the process of competitive liberalization will really roll on in the WTO context and be much more difficult to resist, it seems to me, for the outside of countries like India, Brazil, South Africa, etc. So that's certainly something worth considering, China's disposition on this. But then also the question, and here I want to go back to Professor Nakagawa's presentation, which I thought was excellent, and set out all the issues very crisply. But the one issue that I had a disagreement with, and this is about how to include these rules in the WTO, was about the issue of special and differential treatment, because it seems to me that is actually the most critical issue if you want to include these rules in the WTO. And there I thought, and perhaps we can discuss this, that the trade facilitation agreement might actually be a model worth exploring. How you apply it to rules is not clear to me, so if anybody has got some thinking about that, I'd be very interested to hear it. Okay, so those were some framing remarks of the four excellent presentations. Thanks very much to the presenters for being very disciplined, almost on time. On the subject of which, Nishwan, can we go a little bit over, or should we finish at 1 o'clock exactly? Okay, so let's see how it goes. Let's open the floor. I don't see any hands up. Yes, maybe some time.
Thank you, Jeff. I found all the presentations really fascinating, and what I really liked was also that we were not talking just about value chain, but also about distribution around the value chain. With the issue of global trade becoming unequal, I think this discourse, and particularly in the context of the book by Piketty, Capitalism in the 21st Century, I think we should look at what the value chains mean for low-income income countries and the distribution of income among the participants, along the value chain. So for example, in the context of my own country, if you look at what is the retail value of a shark, it's only 35% which is within our own country. 65% is outside of the country, and mostly it is the services, the buying houses, you know, the retailer, margins, etc. So I think that we also have to look at it and how do we go, you know, come out of the lower end and how we democratize the value addition. And it was also mentioned here that manufacturing services are becoming, a lot of services are embedded in the manufacturing. So that is also becoming very, because in the services sector, we have a lot of comparative disadvantage. So I think all this, and with regard to the other session also, Deep was mentioning whether we will join TPP, and the question is that whether we will have a choice. I remember when I was young, I saw a film. The boy was proposing to the girl and was asking, "What will be your positive answer?" So I just
thank you.
Thank you, Peter. Now, in response to your options for upgrading the value chain, what China has been doing, I observe, is something really interesting. China, of course, has been moving up. And in the process, I think China is also trying to change the rules to make it accommodate more of its own interests. And this, actually, I think, is also related to the regulatory coherence issue that we discussed with regard to mega FTAs. You already observe this to a certain extent in a particular sector, that is the mobile phone sector. In the mobile phone sector, you know, for example, when China was developing, in the past, when China first started manufacturing mobile phones, most of the mobile phones were for foreign consumption. They were not really used in China, but then gradually more and more Chinese use mobile phones to the extent that China surpassed every other country to become the number one mobile phone market. And that is where you see things get interesting. When China manufactures these goods for export, they have to conform to whatever regulatory regimes that of the country that they are exporting to. But when they start, when the domestic market grew more and more important, then China started to develop its own standard with regard to the mobile phone networks, for example, and mandate that the mobile phone manufacturers adapt to these networks. So I think sooner or later we will probably also see this in other sectors as well. That is why I see that it's a pity that the TPP did not include China in the beginning, because gradually, as China moved from over-reliance on export to more reliance on domestic consumption, you will see that the Chinese firms paying more and more emphasis, attention on the domestic market. And this will also give the opportunity for the Chinese government to use the importance of the domestic market to influence the regulatory, to shape the regulatory framework in all these different sectors. And when that happens, I think the U.S. would probably regret what it did in the TPP by excluding China, because, I mean, they could have included China in the first place, and then have China agree to their rules. But when after China develop its own rules tailor-made for its own domestic market, then the U.S. would regret not bringing China into the game in the first place. Now, another short comment on the rules of origin issue. In the TPP, China is excluded. So, for example, on textiles, as Mr. Chang has mentioned, instead of textiles from China, the textiles from Japan will be used. except unless, of course, if the particular texts are brought into the so-called top supply list, which would create an exception. But this is not necessarily a bad news for China, because what we have observed for the past year or two is that a lot of Chinese firms are already starting to relocate to countries like Vietnam, because the labor cost in China is rising rapidly to the extent that they are more expensive in China nowadays than in Vietnam. So they've already relocated to Vietnam, and they become basically Vietnamese firms, and then they will be able to enjoy the benefits of the TPP.
Well, we spent 2 days talking about the marvelous things of the TPP, and that is an agreement of the first 20th century. What I discovered today, this morning, is that TPP is using an instrument of the 16th century, 18th century, that is rules of origin. The same way they discussed this years and years ago. It's amazing for me to see. Come on, I was spent almost 10 years of my life as the head of the rules of origin in WTO. You cannot finish the exercise because the fight of the US and the EU on the three steps and the armed forward methodology. Why? What I'm discovering today, that even so, the lobby of the textile in the US is imposing the same rule for TPP. Dick, this is amazing. Tell me.
We're very good at this.
No, we're not good at this. We are destroying everything because
it's
going to be destructive. Imposing. No, one of the most destructive things is this, the textile rules of origin three steps. It's ridiculous because you are forcing the country to be completely uncompetitive to have the three kinds of operations inside the same region, diverting everything. So it's amazing for me. Now I'm going to say that TPP is such an old agreement as the one on, come on.
I have no disagreement. When I was a young kid working in the previous round, a long time ago, Bob Strauss, one of the great U.S. trade representatives, took me aside and said to me, Dick, you have to understand the function of rules of origin. The rules of origin are the device by which we take back most of the trade liberalization that the other party thought it was getting.
It's amazing. And this will probably impede that TTIP you finish, because you have a huge conflict of powers in the EU and United States on textile. Again, all over again, it's really a fantastic discovery for today. Really, I'm shocked. Completely shocked.
Yes, Michael.
Oh, yes. In response to your Peter's question on the design of S&D in introducing new rules to the WTO, which we need for the accession to the global value chain, yes, it's a difficult part, because if you don't introduce new rules domestically, then firms just don't choose you as a destination of your investment and so forth. So the grace period strategy is just is not functioning. Maybe, but the instant tenuous introduction of new rules is almost impossible for LDCs. So I have no idea, no clear cut solution to that situation. But when you think, maybe you should think about very intensive technical assistance for regulatory reform, additional sponsored by some, I would say, developed countries, Japan has a bit of its experience in that respect when the Asian ASEAN countries introduces a competition law and civil law, etc., with support from Justice Ministry and so forth. And the EU and US also has an experience in when just after the collapse of the Soviet Union, when the Central and Eastern European countries introduced the competition law and other market economy type of legislation. But the size of the funds needed and the size of human resources required for doing such type of exercise to a number of LECs, it's overwhelming. So I have no idea, but yeah.
Yeah.
I'm
sorry, you know,
you go ahead, Joe. Okay, briefly, you know, the one shot game a little bit. what I was saying is that if there is only, final good product, that's good, then, it's just, one FTA between two countries bilateral, right? Then, you can, this may be the efficiency loss because for the third party, but, It can still beat the price without tariff of the FTA members because my price is much lower. That's one again. But now with the global exchange spending, it's gonna consider the next process and the next time you will have to export the product again. So then the new import, you will have to think about which country you are importing from. When we talk about the GVC itself actually does not really distort the market. It's basically the market driven and the efficiency is wise. It's going to be the good for the world economy. But when it is combined with the mega regionals, then it will be the market distortion will be introduced. And if we do not even consider the SMD or some other issues for the inequality, then that will bring some more welfare implications, negatively. As to what Henry mentioned about the Chinese economy relocation, I agree. But when I was saying is that the implication is going to be asymmetric, right, for the countries and the companies even in one country. So for some countries they can relocate. And still, the impact on the Chinese economy will be there, right? It's not going to be about those companies. Maybe so multinationals can be easily relocated, but some of those the SMEs and the economy, the employment of the domestic economy will be still affected by the GDPs combined with the non-regionals.
I don't see any more hands up, so before Professor comes in, in fact, I'd like to suggest that we go back to our panelists to answer any questions, make clarifications, final observations. So,
yeah.
Mr. Van.
Very quickly, if I was to remind you that, this type of product, its production, globalization, concentrated in China, only in China. Actually, in recent years, as I heard, about 20 young workers still died in the factory for producing this type of product. Very low income and very boring and long-term, working. So in China now, this type of global value chain actually labor intensive. Gradually, for young generation, they are reluctant to work for this type of product. They prefer at home. They prefer to work in service sector. And then that's why you can find that a lot of labor intensive, sectors gradually move out from China to ASEAN, to Africa, to Latin American countries. This type of process. For China itself, Now we are encouraging creation. Also, we are increasing, you know, R&D, and we have to chase, you know, so-called innovation-oriented economic development model. We are encouraging Huawei hire Lenovo, this type of, you know, China's transnational cooperation. But of course, we realize that China has to protect IPR, intellectual property, in order to stimulate innovation. Third point on China's, you know, attitude on TPP. I have a paper published by EWC, East West Center in the US. Chapter 5, the topic is how far is from China to TPP. In that, if you are interested, you may, you know, download it from the website. You may find that there is a long gap, there is a deep gap between China and TPP. So my attitude to TPP is quite subjective. I don't agree, you know, conspiracy theory. Also, I don't agree inclusive viewpoints. I think that this is an objective fact, objective existing. So for China now, on one hand, now it, at this stage, it's not the right time for China to join TPP. On the other hand, China as a, you know, trade and investment, liberalization and facilitation promoter, because today China is the, you know, second biggest economy as well as biggest exporters. We have to promote, you know, trade and investment liberalization. But we will follow and we will study, you know, TPP very carefully, and we will seek, you know, possible, you know, regional economic integration in the future. Of course, I agree with, you know, Dr. Chang. Actually, any IPA or regional trade agreements will promote global value chain development in the region and in the global market. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Anything to say? No? Okay.
I'll just make two very fast points that I thought of as we talked. One is that, you know, I hear this argument a lot, well, China can't join, they're not ready, et cetera. And my response to that is often to think, well, that's a bit crazy, right? Vietnam is doing this. And if Vietnam can do this, then surely China can. Especially because the next batch of new entrants for TPP will not be able to sit at the table until at least 2018. And by 2018, I would think if China decides it wants to do this, of course it can do this. So I think that this, we're not ready, we couldn't possibly, this doesn't work for me. And second, I would say on the trade and investment diversion, especially investment diversion, I think that is a real problem in the TPP. I don't think it will be such an issue for China specifically because the domestic market is too attractive and the skill sets and the infrastructure and all of that is very attractive, and that's not going to go away post-TPP. But I think it will be an issue for some members, especially, for example, Thailand is going to be, I think, hugely damaged by TPP because many of those supply chains that are currently located in Thailand are going to say, look around and say, why are we still here? We should pack up and move to Vietnam, where we get zero tariffs on all of our imported goods from the plastics and from the basic raw materials, the plastics, the whatever, the food infrastructure, whatever it has to be, all the way through the final products into TPP member countries. We're going to get access to better services, better investment protection, IP protection, access to procurement markets, access to, you know, customs facility. I mean, all sorts of stuff that you're going to get if you're in Vietnam that you don't get in Thailand. So I think trade and investment diversion is going to be a real issue, but not for every country, but only for those that are participating in the kind of supply chains we see now. In Thailand, for example, Taiwan, two countries that I think are going to be damaged. Probably not so much China because it has, thankfully for China, its unique capabilities and the size of its own market.
Okay, so I think that brings us to a conclusion. Thanks very much to our panelists. I think it was a very robust, rapid-fire session, not quite a one-shot session. So, thank you very much. So I think we're on track to resume probably at 2:15, realistically.
Yeah. At least one.
Yeah. Please just open
it.
Yeah, 1 hour.
Yeah.
1 hour.
1 hour. Okay. So, and then with the final session was really just a few people, including myself, reflecting on the conversation of the last day and a half, 2 days. So I would like to suggest to Foundation Kwan that you start to think now about maximum 3 or 4 key takeaways that you've taken away from the conversation. We throw those quickly into the pot, and then we stir it, we toss it around. 3 or 4 maximum. And I think let's be brief as possible. So 5 minutes, let's maximize the conversation around the table, and Xinhuan will moderate us and tease us and extract.
I'm lost. This will be here.
Yeah, we'll be back here. We're going to walk to lunch, come back here.
Okay. So we'll be back here.
Place up at the
end of
the day? Yes. Okay,
let's go.
Also, can I need your laptop or
Yeah.
You can need your laptop.
Yeah.
It's going to be locked.
Okay.
Thank you.
没喝的怎么办啊？倒了。
这个把那个上面那个杯子给开了，倒了，然后这个托盘还有。
哇，都是沃克斯的咖啡啊。
对呀，那品味。
就离这个近嘛，你来南大的话，还得到你去。
他们是不喝茶的是吗？
喝茶没茶也好，喝喝喝好不好？
完了完了。
有纸吗？拿纸擦呀。
就因为这个是臭杯子。
谁傻了？
没事没事，幸亏没弄到人家包上去。喂。
那里面没纸。
那也不够用，这个。
还不够吗？
嗯。
朋友，你
这
没纸啊？
哎，不是两盒的吗？新拿的那盒也没有了。
那盒呢？你们那个还有？那还有吗？一人十，
龙二那个眼镜，近视也不戴眼镜的人，真是贵。
对呀、啊。够了。
这还有那啥啊，白人高等。没有啊，那不行。还有那个甜，那个曼德拉。
还有，这个还有这个。
咋啦？
太老了，这个玩意我不喝。
有晚上
了，
嗯。
你看你们做这个也行啊，我够尴尬的。
是吧？
我昨天都不敢做这个。
我没做这个，我他们走的时候就做了。
啊！我去，我还以为你做这个。对对对，有的人他不喝那个水，他只要换点水。
不换的。
没有，他们你不懂冬天，冬天也不
换。那啥呀？
那个喝掉的那瓶水给收掉了，
不收了吧？他们有的人，哎，他们有的人就是不让换那水，
不让换的水，
对他们觉得浪费，
他们觉得太浪费。
我天朝财大气粗，不在乎这些东西。
环保是吗？
哦，等三班完，其实我天朝礼节是吧？
我看他们都一起吃饭了，刚刚。
就在学校是吧？
对
呀、
啊，每次都前去。
他肯定就打算
应该是他请他们去那个公司去吃西餐，
那也没什么这么大的饭馆，
就请他比例四楼的，
稍微好一
点。现在是这种，这个什么国际经贸这个谈判，跟那个贸易和国贸跟国际。法律块都挺相关的，
这个摄像头正好。
谈的过程中就是这个，就是一个定规则，就是国际法的要这个定规。
那没有
吗？
那什么，这会议室里边还有
啊？
我看他们今天谈了好多那个什么关于 PPT 跟 TIP 的什么。
变态了，感觉都。
啊，你看，首先是什么？
首先是。
哎，你能不能听我跟你讲什么吗？
啊，我快点。
首先是 PPT，
你听懂吗？
这个翻译。
韩国人，韩国两个人找的，你找下午，你找下午，那个，那个走。看见了吗？
六十五，就这个头发，
对
吧？
这是巴西的，巴西的这个，巴西的。
这也很年轻啊。结果那天他不是有录吗？我一看他那个，
哈哈哈哈
哈。这个不是 memory。
他肯定
没
说。
是吧？
在哪儿呀？
南非。
南非呀。
嗯。
这个，南非跟我有点。
啊，我就觉得在南非。
哈哈哈哈哈。他不会儿他
都
在上厕所，在上厕所，在那上，必须要有坐便。
谁啊？
就是那个。
我知道啊。
他们要轮到三号去上厕所。
叫 Max 入住的，
对 ，Memory
Memory 入住的，好像是那个，就那个黑人的，
对。对。南非什么什么国家经济些东西的一个研究员吧，
跟那个。
跟那个人。
我真的感觉那个那做那个男的跟大一样。
因为
真的神，
没有，
福
气没他高，
头
也是，福气没他高，
四八
练的，你知道，四八练的那福气只有一米六几，
我当时知道福气长啥样了，真的练以后，我们家人说的真的很像，尤其是他这么白的翅膀，
可以叫我怎么样？你在深圳吗？
我也做过领导，好，
我们二十都是领导，
都。
那人家那个大公司的那个开会的时候，不是 CEO
都坐那儿，
人家坐那儿，好吧。
我又就夸奖一下这个，然后
老板帮你拍一张照，
旁边那个财务总监什么的，
对吧？
对，
装一下，
老板有什么指示？
对呀。
要报表。
哎，刚才这么说，
刚才
你要
说，
别说话，
这么多人来，非常好呀。
那个啥，
老板有什么指示？
啊，服务员啊，田园堂那挺好的。
那个把他那个啥，小苏啊，那个什么外头有件事，你这个有个人帮我接过来啊。
没有没有，赶紧给他
接。
这
下
是你吗？
对，这是你，这是你。他这人太逗了，太逗了。
我应该配一个什么文字呢？
别配文字了，行不行啊，大哥？
高
老
板，
高
老板，好的，这个已经过去
了。咱们再来个合影吧。
啊。
在位吗？
赶紧
来专家研讨会，正开幕闭幕都挺
不错的。
你
看
小
哥，来来来，小哥，一左一右，
崇拜，
主席还能成年啊？哎，你这照相是不是特别难讲？那都问你照。
紧张，好的。好。
好。看，下面那个都是
陈月
的。哎，你又往前站的。
那真的没有，
没有，没有报
的。给我传一个，
传到群里去吗？
是吗？你怎么看？
这边
那个有。这是2000万刀，小峰。
不知道，对这个好，这个我想要下面这个字，然后他就可以看到我们参加这个活动。我看一下，然后看到同
学。那我们就在生气别
人
了。
挣的还挺多。刚刚买的吧。
好清楚啊，感觉。
对。
比你拍的清楚多了。
我来看一下。你这刚换的手机？
啊，对，前几段
时间。哪儿？我真的
以前
没有感觉你这么高，女生。
嗯。
你们都是歪的。我的牌子都歪了。
对啊，我的鞋跟都是个高。
我的牌子也是歪，无所谓。那小哥笑得上
面。
那当然。
我
也是。
这
明
年广告。
我牌子又歪了，这个牌子老是我是歪的。
你的牌子，你为什么这么小的细节？
对呀，这么小的细节你都能看到。什么呀？
他的牌子
歪
了。
歪
的。要发群里吗？
发群里边吧。沿途你要发这个群码。 你的点那边，
上去了。
嗯，预览的时候，
预览的时候没有关
系。可以那个，对，预览的时候可以的。
如果你看到这个，
可以等我
吗？啊，对对对对
对。圆珠比较大，一般都是比较好。
嗯，你上次圆珠吗？
他第一次上的。
我学的就一直是接触。
对。
你在说你的老师吗？对。
你刚看我是吧？
啊，对，刚看。
你那天打电话，那你有你好。
你好。你好。你好。
哦，发我的了，对了，刚换了手机，没有。
之前你打电话的时候求我，然后那个发手机。
昨天那张，哎，那个，昨天咱们给他一张，
啊对，
昨
天我，
哈哈哈哈，
为何不能跟别人跟嘉佑在一张在一张在一张照片？因为现在不跟他们在一起照片。
我发一张，你就会觉得你还是地位很高的，那张都是你的。你看
到
对啊，
有吗？
有啊，
你没看吗？
没有没有。
那几点钟？你还指着烧锅底那，你怎么坐下来的？
是不是？就是没有感觉你在那里的，真的感觉。哈哈哈哈哈哈！
哈哈哈哈哈哈！老板太大了。
我靠！我不知道今天他会给我递个水是吧？
对啊，你
知道吗？
我以前没有意识。哇，这家伙我也很帅，我真的。
他是昨天的。
哎，昨天
带
的。
嗯。
哎，你才例外。
嗯，不要把这个乱扔到外头。
我也是歪的，我的牌子也是歪
的。
哎，昨天我拿了一个这个玩
意儿。一个这玩意儿是吧？
哎，那个龙哥，你昨天那张照片有点像我头像，那表情，你看这眼睛。
哎呀，我的天！你要走啊？
嗯。
干嘛去？
学习。然后我那个你打开的时候，就他那边有点，是啊，啊对。后面那个在地上面是。对啊，你刚才你那个房子转弯比较好。
我刚好抓拍到了，我忘了看闪光灯有点暗，那个。
嗯。
有点意思
啊。啊，暗了。就是几个人的密谋是
吧？
老头，你这最后一张图怎么回事？这两张图在干嘛？
啊？
你最后一张图，你两张图在干嘛？你两张图在干嘛？
没有，我当时我那拿手把手机放在那个荷包里，刚拿出来的话，咔嚓它就开了。
刘博，那是因为，老头，这里别开心了。
你说啊，
只要是刘博，只要是就是只要是那个啥，就那啥，消失那个，啊，就是要这个谁看脸了噻？
是
吗？
老头不是英文写的，老头那个中文写的更好。
我们
怎
么
这样子？今天我给你看看，你是吧？这都是真实，是不是？这是赞同，是吧？我把你叫这样子，你说我，你是怎么保存的？我说怎么在我心里保存的？给你看一下。
什么意思？你说
查案就忘了。哦，
是
吧？我
真
是没。
不是吧？你
看
见
那
照片怎么
用
的？
我从来不知道怎么保存，我就截屏了。
老哥，我以为你新人脸是男版的，编版的。
啊，没有，因为我那个卡就不能上网，就是之前那个流量太少了，然后我有两张卡就不能用。
我一直以为老哥那个新人脸是男版编版的，哪个你也不知道的时候。我每次你看我的手机到底存了多少信息的 ，get 到多少信息的？
保存不变就是截止保存的那个原图，还是说是保存？
你要点，给我看。
龙王昨天到那儿的时候，两只眼睛往哪看？那眼睛其实往哪看？
看你了。
对，看我干嘛呀？我靠！看我，看我牌子歪了。
这发什么都点不了。
啊，发现有毒液，就我不住了。
它不是那个真正的东西。哇，这痕迹干嘛？
哎，你什么逻辑？
你什么逻辑？
别看别了。
他的逻辑也不能理解。
上次看到有这么多男生，就是肖晨跟那个人在的，然后别人跟肖晨说我不约吗？是吧？但是他是不想跟你约。是这个逻辑吧？
对，
我觉得我揣摩应该是这个逻辑，
他应该还要得到你的批示才能说。
啊，对，就跟我说非常优惠是吧？
啊，
那行，我同意了。老板，老板同意。哎，他说我给你发，给你发三天假，你跟那个谁。就这么惨呀！我被调查过，他叫多少回了？再少叫少还少，就怕叫老，我怕你叫我老高。
他叫我
呀，
嗯，
叫
我，
一直
喊他。我每次就是喊他叫你老王嘛，每次听这个小王。哈哈哈哈
哈。因为在我们家那里是老和小和你弟，你说你的小姑或者小姨，我们那叫老哥老姨，就是同一个意思。
我不是他老姨，不是小姨。
就小老和小是同一个意思。
老小
老小老小老小。主要是肯定是太有钱了，然后人家还要知道你是一个，这是心态是吧？故意，保再保一个马桶房吗？
在马
桶
房，
大家
好
牛
人
啊！在保利，别的地方还有，保利就蛮好的，保利在保利那地方有什么好地方？马桶房就不错了，那个。投资要放到合理的地方是吧？你家乡没感觉？
是
啊。这种奇怪，你保定人跑到石家庄上去上学，然后他那个金牌跑到保定去上学。对。
保
定那边不干净。
对。
污染严重。
啊，我觉得保定那种保定的土地，以后再打开。
对对，就看
见
了。
是的，啊，在那个。
那个。保定以前是省会，但我们安静的，它是没落的，就是那些。保定啊，以前一直是省会，就是不能拿那个，就把它改成那个石家庄去了。
保定
还
有石家庄很好的。
嗯。
啊，石家庄。
这
保定和石家庄。
这在四川知道吗？这在云南拉手办吗？拉头粉，绝对是拉头粉。
那北京还有高碑店
呢，
高碑店。
嗯，
北京有一个店，
那
个店。
谁干嘛？
高碑店。
那是高碑店。高碑店。
高碑店。
不是一个那个县级市吗？在北京那个高碑店。那就我们在北京南昌高碑店两家店。
高碑店。
高碑店。
北京，我告诉你最大区别，它那个什么路，没有什么路是吧？好多是什么桥，什么堤，什么这种，什么里，就是。我第一次来北京，我真心找不到我当时我按学校那个号码，最近东街十号，就是在什么路上，就是在。就是上海没有，上海就是你就是再小的项目，它都有一个，你都有一个叫什么路名，什么路名，就特再小的项目，它有一个路名。全国几乎所有县级项目，那个在上海都能找到对应的路名。你看，你苏博士在这儿，苏教授在这儿，你还可以。
三十四，好点，差不多。
三十四，
能把你们重新给我用。
三十四。
不是很脏吗？弄不见脏东西。
很快，以后从三元素直接就变成那个那个什么，电脑什么什么，丁是吧？
不是，我是方块。
丁 D E A N 电脑的。我看那个上很多人是什么丁丁丁丁奥是吧？是不是？
哇，那个是电脑。
嗯。你在什么什么什么什么什
么什么什么什么
什么什么什么什么什么什么什么什么什么什么什么什么什么什么什么什么什么什么什么什么什么什么什么什么跟那个冒着你冒着咱们学校的那个学校，
哎，
不是，上南开的啊？上不来南开的吗？哦，不是，江的那个是，对，江什么？
江
平。就这个村，就跟你看看他对啊。
江平。
就是。
嗯。
没有，刘庆明你知道吗？刘庆明跟香港一定啊。也那个是，对啊，那个伙也是，对，聊天这些跟我比较像的那个，还有那个，看看，黑跟我比较像，别的跟我不像，然后还有那个看看那俩都聊天这个，还有一个，古天乐，还有林峰，
古天乐是看
什么？对，都聊综艺的呀，都这种，
还
有哪一个？
你看吴亦凡，他那个。
怎么样？怎么样？有黑的，黑白？
我是黄一奇啊。
没有啊。
好。
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 关键是他回校不是天天聊天。
他是在黑的。
他是假
的，在。在的然后没转回来。
你呢？
我是天阳的。我是阴阳
的。重庆人。
哦，纯天阳。
重庆人。可是你见过纯天阳我们黑的吗？纯天阳都是皮肤可好的。这些人，尤其是女孩，那个。
别说这个
成
都和青岛的，结婚照那个，真是完全两个世界，感觉不可能放弃。
现在比较安逸，人家有一块叫造不住，穿老的衣服，年轻人都知道要造那双，穿那双鞋就，就王不善之过就没有什么进取心了。那他自己安逸，我好多师范同学跟我说，他们那是一般就是上上班，在这我家老家上上班后，平时是看场戏打打麻将，他们也特别打麻将，啊，吃吃麻辣烫没有问题，是，而且重庆房价也不贵，最贵的地方才1万多不同，就均价得8000左右。
你去未来都没什么感觉吗？你觉得哪一辈子是老年人？
对啊，
这
话好严重啊！
因为你现在早就出去了，谁
现在？关键我
关键我
没有，
关键太小了，
人家
那个装
修
啊。
关键我没有，我在威海做了好几种销售，做了好多场，然后我还没人出。威海为什么这小地大这么多地方没有一个，然后上来就说一个没有。没见到一个人呢，我是商场也逛
了，没见到
高慧。
不是吧？
真的是。
高
慧不是吗？
他那时候不在威海。
你一个替我们学校看，就那天今天几个姑娘，那个韩华，特别的高在上。
哎，你们怎么喊他的？
就是感觉到为啥这个他老大不是这里住的这个吗？
你说。你怎么会去成都？
我去那个东方去那边玩儿啊。
哦，你去那玩儿是吧？
那真的是感觉大街上没有多少车，没有多少人。
成都这特别适宜居住，它地中海城市，而且就是那个生活节奏也还比较慢，然后这个人也不多，也不容易，不跟人
走吧，
可以的。
我们不要再走，这俩，那这两个。
对。你今天玩了是吧？
玩了。
泡温泉吗？
没有，不是那里边有温泉。
旁边有。
那旁边没去。
人没法玩了是吧？是吧？真的。
好想试一下。
那个，忘了那个。
我是北京游乐园。
我们那我们那里。
刚才在。
我在这
边有
个真的知道
海盗船的那种，然后它是边旋旁边的，那个月亮不行。然后我在上面的时候就
吐了。上面就吐了。
对。
那是跟妹子一起去的吗？这是。
哎呀，真的不给。
那还好。这样。啊，不是，那妹子今天太这样子太舒服了。
然后那边整个集体都因为我。
就因为你行了。
对，那
个。我主要问他，我主要是觉得害怕，因为好多那个新闻报道说那个突然断电啊，突然那个坏了什么的。
没有，那刚刚停下来，然后
好
玩一下。
我就那种新闻报道，突然那个断电了，然后咔，那个设置老化是吧？各种设置不敢做，我就害怕，这个太危险了。
我在石
家
庄那
时
就是去植物园嘛，那个也是从小去玩那个过山车，但是火车嘛，我们这没有一两周就说那个过山车断了啊。
地图一个冷淡。
所以不在就不行，真的不行。
对。
因为做了研究，有什么跟其他的这个跑步的，
成人还有跟那种狗肉也是在一起玩。
狗肉也都有。
真的是。
哦，童年的都有，因为童年太大了，真的是。
你就特意去杭州童年了？还是顺便去的？
是成都。
啊，去南方附近玩逛了。
对，大二的时候出去了，然后连跑了全家在这儿去了。
那玩去玩儿，旅游的话，南京比较贵，有一点，南京就有一点贵。
嗯。
南京的话。
我家那个店就是三五十那
个。对。南京挺，就那一去了。过了那个之后，看起来，你要是那个十一去的话，那就没那啥了。我五一去过一回那个去玩儿，他们坐那个公车去，那车走了，开车给你走过去买卖，特别特别，就全是人，
全是
车。平时的那种淡季的时候去还挺好。
是淡季的话，你去吗？
啊。
嗯。
淡季搞回去。
我也没淡季，也单身多，去了以后真的是。
今天定的那个反胃了，看了之后。
原来是那个杭州不是有个温泉好多吗？
啊。
那个就感觉活生生就是在我看来就是十几块哈。
对对对。
就是那十三块，然后接着就老多，我一打完我就。
你有没有看到头晕？
对呀，就是。
看着，特别血腥的场面，对吧？
因为中间吧。
冰石在那里血腥吗？
不是，
他说看那个。
我下午看完电影，然后就去那个
唱红
灯。
联想了一下。
对呀，真的是，我是说看完那场景特别
有。就这以前有过一遍，就看那个，就是拍联想他的片，特别漂亮。
南京，
还少一点我记得，
就
南京
有啊。
就是那个，就是那个他那个放的，看完
没有人说都南京。
那个跑进去的特别深啊，视频啊是那种，一个个被抓
住，真正的感觉就是那个城市。
南京就是。怨气特别重，
肯定是的。
怨气特别重
啊，怨气特别。
南京的人是，不管是在那个梅庄上还是啥位置，他的整个近代史上就是被屠了好几遍，你在底下尸骨一层铺了一层，近代尸骨放在旧的尸骨上面。那个太平天国的时候，你们是南京是首都嘛？太平天国首都嘛？宫廷制的时候，那个张居和怀庆宫廷大概是那人，他忘了。
就感觉
上
太
少，
但是
你地
理有点太
少
了，我感觉。
刚才
那地理我学了就忘
了，对，这个东西嘛，就是你感兴趣的话你就记得住。你看地理有的不是地理，好像非常不会，不见得非常没地方。这东西你有兴趣你就记得住。我有一点特别搞笑，为什么我看历史书、看历史事件，我看了一遍，我就多看第二遍。
我读的速度，
自己在童年不知
情，又黑我
了。牛皮五花
七，
接下来就是你要再说说，
黑我，
哇，肯定和大家说了，
对呀，
我感觉我
听不懂。
下次再给你再来一个注释。
这个是我看那篇文章之后，我那个就是。是我看这个文章之后给他，我给这个文章这个给定。
对
吧？
因为大家实在是拍到什么，对吧？
花要飞我。
中考之前在看那个金庸小说《笑傲江湖》，一下就这样看，然后高中的时候今天就对老师没收，说老师我们刚开学期，对，看各种东西，就是各种，就跟高考无关的各种，就是不是那个高考，跟高考考试无关的东西，通通被没收。我第一天，我刚才高中第一天晚上，我们是刚第一天晚上上晚自习就没收了一本《红楼梦》，跟我同学俩的。
我看
过
是
吧？我
看
过
看那个
就
是那个老板的
红楼梦电
视剧。
你
还
有
老
板的吗？对呀。那么老？
就是那个嘛，就是你的
词，就是你结呀写的是那个。你说的是那个八六版吗？就那个。
八六版吗？
不是新的那个李
尚
红的那个。
啊，不是的，我们那个在剧。然后就是那个人看你都看不出来
那个。那个是有意思。他那个吧，就是有图像，有那个，可能就是有人物关系，跟那个。你要看书的话，你就记不住，不知道这个人是谁，怎么办？
我
下
的
书
我只喜欢看，也喜
欢
西游
记。
西游
记。
这个没有涵养的人。
我也喜欢看西游记。
不是，我跟你讲，你要那么多西游记的话，你要那么多西游记的话，你会西游记其实里面道道很多，你可以百度马上百度来解读西游记，你道道特别多。
我那人太复杂了。
道道特别多，不是你表面看那种没有用，那种我小时候就有，看小时候没用过，为什么孙悟空看那么厉害？到后来就各种要不然不，我小时候这是我最大的看那个《西游记》电视剧的最大的一个疑问，为什么孙悟空那一开始那么厉害？我一开始，后来这妖怪打过，那妖怪打过，每次都要叫人帮忙，就而且之前给他帮忙的时候，都是连打死带外将，都是跟那种，你看他老师一开始那么强，他为什么他老师那个理由那么厉害？他老师那个弟子那么厉害？因为给他老君那个三楼的两个公主看了，就把他给干掉了。
你想太多了，你看累吗？你就是打的我一口口，你就在那想，
哎呀，还。你这不是很奇怪吗？这不觉得很奇怪吗？没有这个疑问吗？
那。
Thank you. Fell asleep.
I
我的天，飞机啊！
When he got him very late.
Yeah.
You're looking very skeptical, aren't you?